Accession number 28735, Reel 2.
Rickman, Reel 2.
One evening, the sergeant said, now I'm going to show you how to throw a Mills bomb. Let's go out in the garden. And we went out into the garden of this house at the back, and he stood us in a row, and he said, now down the other end there, you see there's a foxhole, there's a trench I dug down there, and we could just see this gap down there, the length of a cricket pitch sort of thing away. And he said, now this is a Mills bomb. It's not a real one, of course, it is a real one, but it hasn't got anything in it. So there's no pin, and it's just a matter of getting you practicing so you can throw it, get it in the pit. Right, number one, he says, and the first chap steps up and gets hold of it and bowls it, of course, and he hits the ground 5 feet before it and doesn't get there. The rest of the platoon do it. None of them got it really anywhere near it, which I was surprised, because I thought it shouldn't be that difficult. Seeing as how I was a good bowler and an accurate bowler at school, only a couple of years before, and I was standing there as the last one, and he said, well, you call it cyclist messenger? Yeah, you can have a throw, son, here you are. He chucked this thing at me, and I grabbed this main chunk of the Mills bomb and thought, well, I think it's a bit longer than the cricket pitch, so I need to just get a good length on it, and about 10 feet longer than usual. Turned over my arm, and it went right up there, cannoned up, plop, straight into the pit. I suppose I thought the sergeant was going to say, well done, son. What he actually said was, you're not supposed to do that. There's 2 feet of water in it, and I've bloody well got to go down and get it. Yeah. And the other incident was, one was night duty. Did night duty occasionally. And they said at the start of this night duty, half past six, something like that, we are next, Rains Park is next to Wimbledon. He said, Wimbledon have rung up and they want some volunteers. They want 6 volunteers to go over. Anyone want to go for the night? I put my hand up, well, this might be interesting. So 5 of us, and myself, plus my bike, got put in the back of a van and driven over to Wimbledon, to the police station. And it's the only time in my life that I can claim to have slept in a police cell, to start with, for no apparently good reason whatsoever. The fact was that was the only accommodation there was, and there wasn't anything to do there, but there might be if there was an air raid, you see. Which, sure enough, I was asleep, fully clothed, naturally, on this spring sort of mattress. Greyish khaki colour, and a triangular wedge for a sort of pillow. However, I was asleep on it, and the sergeant shook me round about, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Come on, son, fall in outside, quicker. Chop, chop. So I rush outside, we get in the van, and we drive off to this Cannon Hill Common, where the gun batteries are. And the sergeant says, now look, fellas, as you can see, there are about 100 incendiaries which have been dropped all over this common, all in between the guns and outside. Our job is to put them out. So we said, good, yeah, okay, sergeant, how do we do that? Oh, he said, that's a funny thing, because we haven't got any tools, have we? It was February, mid-February, frozen, ground was as hard as iron and slightly whitish with our lime, and we stood there in absolute silence best part of a minute, and suddenly the sergeant said, "Tell you what, chaps, you take off your tin hats and you use them as a shovels, and you dig up as much earth as you can with your tin hat, and then you go and put it on this phosphorus bomb that's sputtering and exploding there." And we spent best part of, I think, probably an hour, these 10 men hopping about in the dark with the guns going off, of course, yeah. And he's trying to dig up earth, frozen earth, with a tin hat, which I wanted to have on my head, not in my hands. But an amusing incident, one might say, looking back on it, which I wondered, really, when the series Dad's Army came out later on, do you see, I wondered why it didn't contain incidents like that. They were all made up, humorous, but it was meant for a laugh, and it got a laugh, and I although I didn't like watching it to start with, because it wasn't a bit like my experience of the Home Guard, nevertheless one got to like it, because it was just so well put together, you know, very good.
Did you stay with the Home Guard when you went with the art school, when it was evacuated to Northampton?
No, I had to leave and go to Northampton. I wasn't there very long before I was called up. That is to say, my parents had had my call-up papers sent to my home address, and they posted them on to me, which said, "Report to your local drill hall as soon as possible." There was a drill hall at Far Cotton, that's in the south of Northampton. And so one fine summer morning, I was in shorts and shirt, and me and my Raleigh bike, which I'd had repaired. I used to cycle to Northampton. It was 80 miles from South London. I used to cycle back home weekends and so on, hang on the back of lorries, you know, it's pretty good. But I call up papers in hand, I rode down to the drill hall and got off my bike, stood it against the railings outside, and outside a big double door which led into this drill hall, there was a regimental sergeant major, very smart, shiny belt, buckles, and swagger cane under his arm. And he said, "Hello, son, been called up, have we?" And I said, "Yes, Sergeant, yes." "Right," he says, "you come along with me, we'll go and do it." We went through the double doors, and we went inside, and he said, "Now then, son, you see them chairs over there?" I said, "Yes, Sergeant." He said, "Now you take off all your clothes, and you put them on one of those chairs. And then you come and see me, and I'll give you a piece of paper, and you take that piece of paper, and you will see those five doctors in white coats on those tables. You go and see each one of them in turn, and they will fill in your paper. And when you finish, you bring it back to me. Is that all right? You understand?" I said, "Yes, Sarge." "Right then, off you go." So, naked, carrying my little piece of paper, I reported table number one, who looked in my ears and my nose and my throat and said, "Well, okay, tick the form." I went to number two. Forget what he did. In fact, I'm not sure what two and three did at all. I do know what number four did, because I stood in front of him and he said, "About turn." I thought, that's a funny thing to say. I about turned naked, and he said, feet astride, touch your toes." Touch my toes. "Right, open your cheeks." So I went, "No," he said, no, son, "the cheeks of your ass." Oh, well, I didn't know what piles were. I didn't know they ever looked for these things. And anyway, "All right," he said, "next doctor." So I went to the last one and got ticked off and went back to the sergeant. and said, "There we are, Sarge, all filled in." He says, "Right, now you get all your clothes on and you come back and see me," which I did. And he said, "Right, son, right, what service do you want to join? Army, Navy, Air Force?" I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, Sergeant, I'd rather like to volunteer for air crew in the Fleet Air Arm, if that's possible." "Oh, no, can't do that, son." I said, What do you mean, Sarge? Well, can't do it. Of course I can volunteer." "Oh, no, you can't," he said. I said, "But why not?" He said, "Because you've been called up. See? If you wanted to volunteer, you should have volunteered before you was called up." And I said, "But Sarge, nobody ever told me that. I never knew that was the case. How am I supposed to know? Chaps of my age who don't read newspapers, and not everybody had a wireless set even in those days. You didn't know." He says, I'll tell you what, look, you take your bike outside and you ride up and down for 10 minutes, and then you come back and volunteer, all right?" I said, yes, sir. 10 minutes later, I come in. I come back to the front door, and he's standing outside, and he's saying, "Hello, son, been called up, have we?" And I said, "Oh, no, Sarge, I come back to volunteer." "Ah," he said, "let's go in then." So we go in, and he says, "Now, you see them chairs over there? I want you to take all your clothes off and put them on one of them chairs." I said, "But Sarge, I did that 10 minutes ago." "Ah," he said, "that has nothing to do with it. That's when you was called up. Now you're volunteering, see, that's different." "Yeah." I said, "Yes, Sarge, I see." So I strip off again, he gives me another piece of paper, and I go to the doctors, number 1, 2, 3, and 4. When I get to number 4, he says, "Feet astride, touch your toes, open cheeks." I knew what to do, didn't I? And I opened my gluteum maximus muscles and waggled them apart. And he said, "Look, Pierre," and he said, "haven't I seen you before somewhere?" And of course he had. However, end of calling up process here. What do you want to talk about now then?
Well, what happened next, obviously, after you volunteered? And I was wondering before that, why did you wanted to volunteer for Fleet Air Arm? Was there any reasoning behind that?
Yes. Well, that goes back a long way, because I guess by when I was about 6, might have been 7 years old, my father happened to buy or obtain from somewhere a what we call an annual, a large book. It was about the First World War, and he, having served in it, that's why he bought it and why he was interested. But I was allowed to read it, and I could read it by then, and I suddenly found there were things called Sopwith Camels and Fokker D7s and SE5As, and there were pictures there, and I suddenly found myself fascinated by airplanes. And when I was 8, a boy at school, at St John Bowyer School at Clapham, a boy called Len Tyrrell, he said, "I'll show you something." And out of his pocket he pulled a model airplane which he'd made. He said, "I made this out of firewood. It was only about 5 inches long, but it was a biplane, had a fuselage and two wings and a tail and elevator and sort of rudimentary undercarriage." I said, "Goodness me, you may just cut that and did all that with a penknife out of firewood." He said, "Yeah." And he says, look, I fitted the propeller on the front, and provided you put a little bead behind it on the pin, it goes round when the wind blows. I said, God, I must make one of those. And I started to make my first model aeroplane at the age of 8. So by the time I got to 11 and 12 and 13, I had made a number of scale models, getting bigger and bigger each time. I say scale models, I hadn't got the plans for the planes, I'd only got sort of photographs from my dad's book and one or two other copies of, I think, a magazine called Flight, which someone, one of my older brother's friends, had let me look at. No. Anyway, I had started to make flying models and to try to design model gliders by the time war came and I was evacuated. And therefore, I had begun to learn some rudimentary aerodynamical principles of flight. And since my father came from Cowes in the Isle of Wight, and I had an uncle who was a petty officer in the Navy, my father's father had served on a two-masted schooner as a crewman. I've got a picture of that on the room next door here. I wanted to fly with the Navy, not with the RAF, you see. I didn't know, as you don't know when you volunteer for things, so what difference it makes one way or the other. I tell you, it does make a hell of a difference, because there's a lot of difference between being a fleet air pilot in the middle of a gale in the Pacific, yeah, when the deck you're landing is going up and down 40 feet at a time, yeah. Compared with the RAF, things like the Lancasters, who just landed driving a bus, you see, onto a great big motorway on an aerodrome, which keeps absolutely still.
Did you follow the kind of exploits of the famous aviators in the 1930s at all, when you were growing up?
I was aware of them. I won't say followed them, in the sense I could only... I think my parents did start to have a daily newspaper then, the News Chronicle, I think, when it first came out. And so Amy Johnson and people like this, whose world-breaking records achieved a fair amount of publicity worldwide then, one was aware of this, although I didn't really know very much about the actual workings of what aircraft they were flying and what its capabilities were. So that I was told, but at the end of this drill hall business and so on, I would be informed as to what was going to happen. And sure enough, within a week, I was told to go to Cambridge and be interviewed and physically tested. It took, I should think, best part of 3 hours, because I had to go. I guess there were five of them. I guess they were all admirals. They certainly had so many rings on them. I didn't know what the ranks were then, but they shot questions at me to test my intelligence and my mathematical ability. And I can remember some of the questions even today, but doesn't matter enough. I've written this down in an article.
Yeah, can you let me know an example of some of the types of things that were asking you to try and work out your intelligence?
It's now twice as many minutes past 2 as it was 2 half an hour ago. What time is it? I thought, I know that sort of thing. 20 past and 10 to, you see, half an hour ago, the time is 10 to 2. Yeah. They asked me things about, of course, you know, an internal combustion engine, yeah, which valve would wear out quickest, be the inlet or the exhaust, you see. I didn't know anybody who got a car, even let alone a motorbike, let alone any other sort of engine. And I just had to say, on general assumption knowledge, as it were, oh, it must be the exhaust valve. And when he said, why, I thought, I don't really know, but I suppose from the impurities, I said. and the heat, he said, as well. But I passed, oh yes, you've heard of the brown shirts, haven't you, the Nazi followers. Who were the red shirts? Followers of Garibaldi, sir, said I. One question I happen to know, I've no idea where I got the information from, but I did know. And so at the end they said, well, you seem to be the right sort of chaps that we're looking for.
Did they ask you about your sporting activities at all?
Did I?
Did they ask about your sporting activities?
No. No, because as soon as I'd seen the admirals, I was told to follow the petty officer into another room, and I was given a full hour of physical testing, particularly eyesight and particularly in the dark. Tiny little pinpoints of light, what colour is it? So at the other end of a room, you know. They were testing night vision in particular, and ability, breathing and so on, hold the tube of mercury up above 30 and so on, and keep it there for well over a minute, hold your breath for that sort of time. Balance, they checked every physical aspect you could normally think of. At the end of which, I go back to the admirals and they say, right, you're physically A1B, that's top grade physics, you're the sort of chap we're looking for. We think your mathematics could do with a bit more improvement. I got as far as quadratic equations, actually, at school. But they said, so what we're going to do is we're going to release you to deferred service for a year. We haven't got places for you. You're the sort of chap we want, but we want you in a year's time. It turned out to be 18 months, actually, in the long run. But in the meantime, I was to go back to my arts studies and do a couple of evenings a week mathematics. One-to-one training with some retired mathematician, you know, in Northampton. Until the time came when in 1942 I was called up properly and had to go to Butlin's holiday camp at Skegness, where I took off all my civilian clothes and was awarded free, didn't have to pay for it, a sailor's uniform, gold bottoms, a nice collar. And that was the start of 4.5 years of service with the Navy.
Was that HMS Royal Arthur?
That's right, that's Royal Arthur.
Can you tell me what the camp was like, how it was organised and what it looked like?
It's a big place, obviously. There were 4 main dining halls. I think they may have been used for other purposes as well as dining, I don't really know. But because I never went there in holiday time, for a holiday, but while we were there, of course, these dining halls held 1,000 men each. So there were 4,000 men at this place. And we were given into the charge. There were 30 of us, I think, near enough, and we were given into the charge of a retired chief petty officer from World War One, Petty Officer Callahan, Chiefy. He had a bicycle, and we were taken round the chalets, great long chalets. Normally, chalets had 2 beds in them, or one bunk, one sideways, one the other way. But because of numbers necessary, 3 of us had to sleep in space for 2, so someone had to sleep on the floor. We just took that in turns. And we were arranged alphabetically. So me being R, I was down the list, and I had Ray Rawbone was his surname, Rickman was mine, and Ted Stevens, he was the first of the S's, so we 3 were in there. And we Were woken in the morning at 20 to 6 by Chief Callahan riding his bike along and banging on our door with a thundering great stick and saying, "Wakey, wakey, 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 the sun's burning your eyeballs out, come on, up to your git." And then on the next one, you could hear this knocking coming, of course, yeah, and it bashed on your door, and then it went down the line. And you dressed, but not in your uniform, you dressed into PE kit. He told you, he told us as he was shouting along, PE kit or uniform. Because before breakfast, we would go, if it were a running kit, shorts and vest, plimsolls, we would go onto the parade ground and we would have a steaming hot cup of cocoa. So hot, I personally couldn't drink it out of the cup, so the way I had to pour it from one cup to another. I've never been very good with hot drinks, at least not that sort of hot drink. And we would then have half an hour's PT, very strenuous PT. If we didn't do that, we went on a route march, normally dressed, overcoats on, and so on, keeping in step, learning how to march in step, singing a few songs that we knew jointly. I can't remember what they were now. Pack up your troubles, I dare say, that sort of thing. So 6:15 before breakfast when we came out, and then lessons. Now, whether it was seamanship, whether it was rowing, they had a few, two or three I think, large whalers, which are about as long as this room, 15 feet long, and with oars, but they were in a swimming pool, so the boat was fastened to a matrashing pool. You never went anywhere, of course, but it was just a matter of getting the action together and so on. So we did this imitation rowing, as it were, which was quite stupid, because I don't know what that achieved at all. But however, that was one of the activities. The other one I found most interesting, and given, strangely enough, by a most unusual person, was Aldis. The Aldis is the name of a signalling lamp used by the Navy, and it was just called using Aldis, but it meant signalling with this lamp, dots and dashes, and so on. So we had to learn to read visual Morse and to send it with the other orders. And our instructor was a chap who was older than us, obviously, and yet he looked twice as old as that. No. Because he was one of the three survivors of the Hood. There were only three out of nearly 1,500 men that went down with the battle cruiser when the Bismarck sank her in the Denmark Sea. And this chap, I cannot for the life of me remember his name now, unfortunately. But he is still alive, I think, even today, because I did see him on some news programme a year or two ago.
Was it Ted Briggs?
That sounds as if it could be right. It doesn't sound quite right, but anyway, he was good at all this. So you learnt, you had a great respect for this man, of course, as a survivor from that incident and so on, and most impressive, you know. So buckle to it and keep your mind on the job.